pursuing criminal activity, exposing the truth, holding people accountable is noble and righteous. We are the state's money cop. Our statutory authority to investigate and to gather information is quite broad.
You're listening to Mike Donovan, a former state prosecutor, a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Tennessee, and currently the chief investigative counsel for the Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
I felt like I didn't have enough time to really develop the cases that need to be developed because they take so long.
In this episode, we discuss the role of the Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury, the authority it has to conduct financial investigations, the ways it receives cases to investigate, the education experience needed to be a forensic examiner, and the effect of COVID on the United States justice system. He is a former United States attorney with the Western District of Tennessee and currently the chief investigative counsel at the Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury. Mike Donovan, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thank you, Robert. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure having you, Mike. How did you get interested in law?
Even into high school, I was always interested in the legal system and in courts. Grew up in the 70s and 80s. As I moved along in my education, I really found that I was fairly proficient in writing, social studies, and those types of arts, opposed to math and science. Really, I kind of developed my skill set for the interest in law from what I felt like I was good at, which was analytical thinking and writing. It appealed to me, and that's kind of where it took off, senior year in high school and as I got into college.
So what did you do between starting your law career, being a law student, to going to the comptroller's office? What steps did you take?
I didn't really go about my career in the conventional way, as it turns out. I like to say that all I ever really wanted to be was a prosecutor, but I had to become a politician to do it. And actually, for the first 11 years of my law career, I was in private practice. I was actually in private solo practice in rural West Tennessee, where I lived and grew up. And for the most part, spent a lot of time in state criminal court doing criminal defense. I was appointed by several local judges to represent indigent defendants who were charged with crimes and could not afford attorneys. And that was everything from DUI and theft to aggravated assault and narcotics, child abuse, all the way up to first degree murder. And for the first 11 years of my law practice, I was a criminal defense attorney in several rural counties in West Tennessee. And I really kind of had it backwards because I felt like at that time that the sole goal of being an attorney was to make money, as we do in our careers, in our lives. I think I finally grew up and recognized that there was something more and more important that I could do for my community and do with my career. After that time on the defense side of the courtroom, I ran for the position of elected district attorney, was successfully elected by the people in 2006 to be the chief state prosecutor in five counties in West Tennessee. And I held that position for another 11 years, being reelected once. So a two-term elected district attorney. Very much enjoyed my time. And really once I became a prosecutor, I knew that I'd kind of found my life's calling and really my sweet spot in the law and what I felt like I was made for. And in 2017, my name was recommended to the White House for consideration to be appointed to serve as the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Tennessee. And thankfully, President Trump nominated me in 2017, and I was confirmed and then served as the chief federal prosecutor there in West Tennessee from 2017 to 2021. And then when I left the Department of Justice last year, I was able to come on board here with the Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury, where I continue to work in investigations of financial fraud, waste, and abuse involving publicly funded agencies and government corruption.
Interesting. So what is the comptroller's office? What is that? Does every state have a comptroller?
I believe that every state has some version of it. Many people might refer to the comptroller in their other states as maybe the state auditor or perhaps state finance director. Here in Tennessee, the Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury is a constitutional office. It is provided for in the Tennessee Constitution, and the comptroller himself is elected by a majority vote of the Tennessee General Assembly, the legislative body of the state. He serves at the will and the pleasure of the legislature and is primarily charged with the fiscal integrity and management, financial management of all state finances and resources for state and local governments. The Tennessee Comptroller's Office is quite large, has a number of divisions, including local government audit and local government finance, state audit, property assessments, state government finance, the State Board of Equalization, and then ultimately where I work in the Division of Investigations. And so I think that most people would think about our office really as the state auditor. Within my specialty in my division in investigations, we focus on allegations in cases of fraud, waste, and abuse of taxpayer-funded agencies, and we refer those matters for prosecution in either state or federal court.
So what type of cases does your office work?
Any type of public corruption by public officials that involves theft of government money or property or services, forgery or falsification of government documents, official misconduct and public corruption in office, and those types of things. Again, anything that involves fraud, waste, or abuse in either a criminal setting or can have some other civil consequences as well, or administrative consequences. And examples could be if the mayor of a municipality in Tennessee is abusing the city credit card for personal benefit, we might investigate that. If a state agency director receives grant funding for a certain purpose and misallocates or misappropriates those funds for a different purpose that involves personal benefit, we might investigate that. Everything from mayors and clerks and sheriffs all the way up to state cabinet level departments, schools, utilities, and even nonprofit organizations that ultimately receive government funding as well. And our scope and our authority is quite broad to audit and investigate those agencies, to really dig in and make sure that we are protecting taxpayer resources. Comptroller Jason Mumpower, who I serve, often refers to our office as the money cop. We are the state's money cop. We want to root that out and we want to make sure that we promote respect and trust in governmental entities in the financial area.
Your office is part of what we call generally the state auditor's office. So where are you getting your leads? If you're not auditing, how is your office come, your section of that office come into play? Is it from informants? Is it from data analysts? How are you getting the cases to work?
We have a few different areas and streams of information and reporting that we can use to open and begin investigations. So first, under state law, the comptroller maintains a public hotline and is advertised at all state and local agencies that if any member of the public knows about or has suspicions or receives information that indicates that an agency is engaged in any type of illegal behavior or fraud, waste, or abuse, that we have a 1-800 hotline number, as well as an online reporting form where people can go to the comptroller's website and can actually make a report that way. All of those hotline reports, whether they are via telephone or internet, are directed into our Division of Investigations where they are assessed and triaged and really examined and reviewed. Also, there are CPAs that are contracted with local governments to perform regular audits. If they encounter or discover any fraud, waste, or abuse, they have a mandatory duty to report under the statute. Many times those CPAs will send us their audit findings, which indicate some type of fraud that we can act upon. And then finally, under state law, every public official in Tennessee, whether you are elected or appointed, has a mandatory duty to report fraud, waste, and abuse within their own agency if they find out about it. Between the public, private audit through CPAs, and through public officials and government employees themselves, we receive quite a number of referrals and allegations and notifications of those things, and then we have a system set up within our division to assess and triage and act upon those or to refer those to other state or local agencies that where it might be more appropriate.
What is the most common scheme you're seeing? I would guess it'd be the abuse of a government credit card. What are you seeing out there?
In this day and time, many government agencies have ceased to operate or to deal strictly in cash transactions, and so many of them are utilizing credit cards or purchasing cards or invoice systems that can be manipulated for payment and redirected for personal benefit. So primarily, we see that type of thing. Now, occasionally, we do also see some straight theft of cash proceeds or receipts into clerk's offices or other agencies that deal with cash payments from the public. Mm-hmm. But primarily, I would say that the scheme is not that sophisticated, although many times the cover-up, it can be sophisticated. We can have invoices and purchase orders and travel claims and other things that are manipulated and falsified using computers, other means, falsification or simulation.
So what type of enforcement powers do you have? I know the federal government would have the grand jury subpoena, and you're familiar with this, being the former U.S. attorney, and you would also have search warrants and seizure warrants. What authorities does your office have when it comes to investigating? I'm assuming you don't have to say pretty please. You have to have some. You can have some type of documents. Just turn it over or else.
This is quite unique, and really, I didn't understand the full breadth of the authority of the Comptroller of the Treasury until I came to work here. And even in my prior service as a district attorney and a U.S. attorney, I had worked with the Comptroller's Office on investigations. But our statutory authority to investigate and to gather information is quite broad. First and foremost, we are not a law enforcement agency, but we do exercise traditional investigatory powers of law enforcement. The only thing we cannot do and we do not do is we do not have the power to arrest or to engage in any custodial type of situation. So all of our investigations are non-custodial. And under state law, there is a statute that essentially says that any public agency receiving public tax-funded resources is required to cooperate with our investigations. So at any moment, we can send investigators into a mayor's office, into a government entity, and we can command and commandeer all of the books, all of the devices, all of the transactional detail that exists within that public agency for inspection, for copying, and for evidence collection. And that can include laptops and cell phones that are used for official purposes. State and local officials are required to cooperate with us under that statute. Additionally, we do have administrative subpoena power, and we have the power also to have assistance from other state agencies in doing our work to enforce those powers. Many of those agencies are law enforcement agencies that can help us with necessary search warrants, custodial interrogations, other things like that. And so our authority is quite broad. One of the things that makes us a little different, we are primarily a reporting agency. Public audits are routinely publicly reported. Ultimately, once there is a completion of an investigation by the comptroller's office, the results and findings of that investigation are made public once there is a charging decision by a prosecutorial agency. So our enforcement ultimately ends up with our investigative findings being referred to a district attorney or a U.S. attorney for some type of criminal activity, or to the state attorney general's office for some type of civil action, whether it be an ouster proceeding to remove a public official from office, or a civil proceeding to recover misappropriated or converted funds. Once that legal action has taken place, we issue a public report that promotes confidence and transparency with the public.
So how big is the office that does this type of work?
So the entire Tennessee Comptroller of the Treasury has about 550 employees. Those employees are spread out all over the state of Tennessee in multiple field offices and in multiple different divisions. Our division of investigations, we're right at 40 employees. I'm the chief lawyer for the division, and I think we employ about 37 or 38 investigators full-time. They go out into the field and conduct these investigations. The investigators that I'm working with now here in the comptroller's office are some of the best and brightest I've ever seen. I've worked with a lot of different law enforcement agencies in my career as a prosecutor, from the Secret Service to the IRS to the FBI to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation to local law enforcement. And these are some of the most highly trained and educated people I've worked with, and it's quite a pleasure. They are subject matter experts. Most of them are either CPAs or CFEs. Certified fraud examiners, their work product is outstanding. And we don't have to just be right. We have to be perfect. And we are in those findings that we make. Many times that also not only result in criminal findings of fraud, but also result in other types of findings, deficiency findings or internal control findings, where we go back to the local government or the state government agency to make corrections, corrective action plan, because that's important. We want to make government work better. And the way that we make government work better is we root out fraud, but then we help the victimized agency understand maybe where the deficiencies were that led to the fraud or that allowed the criminal activity to occur. And so by doing that, we believe we're making government work better for the people.
So if someone in the audience says, you know what, I want to be that type of person. I want to work for the Tennessee Comptroller's Office or something similar in their state or in their country. What qualifications or credentials or degrees are you looking for, or do you think that other states are looking for to be that investigator?
And again, I mean, obviously, I'm an attorney, and if you're going to be working in the legal division of...
Well,
of,
attorneys of don't count. Come on. You know attorneys just take the information and go to court with it. They don't do the work. Come on, Mike. Who's the wind beneath the wings of the attorneys? That's what I want to know.
you're exactly right. The investigators do all the heavy lifting in order to be considered for employment in the division investigations, or really even in our audit divisions. You need to have a background in accounting. So we require at least a minimum of 18 hours of college-level accounting classes and courses. It'd be helpful also if you have a background or a degree in criminal justice. Many of our investigators are, as I said, are CPAs or certified fraud examiners with a background perhaps in other government agencies with prior audit experience or prior law enforcement experience. I would suggest to you and to your listeners that if you're interested in this type of work, you would really want to get into an agency that working in the area of criminal justice or public auditing or accounting for those purposes.
So what type of tools are being used by your office? I have a vision usually with when it comes to finances, it's Microsoft Word, it's Excel, for the most part, possibly some type of database where you can research assets and that type of thing. What type of tools are being used in your office?
But yeah, those general tools that you talk about with analyzing financial data, and I don't want to reveal too much of our sources and methods and techniques, but I'll say that obviously, just like any other investigatory agency, we're using everything at our disposal, whether it is law enforcement databases or other databases that allow us to identify assets, other things that we might want to know about the financial history of a subject or an agency or a bank account. And again, we have subpoena power to obtain bank records, educational records, medical records, employment records, really any type of record that is relevant and germane to our investigation. We partner quite frequently with other agencies who have additional law enforcement tools that we're able to share resources and intelligence with.
If someone was interested in this career, what advice would you give?
There's a certain type of person that we're looking for. You've got to be naturally inquisitive. You've also got to be a person that is very meticulous in the way that do your business. You've got to be independent and objective. We receive allegations, we audit and investigate agencies, and we are not part of those agencies. We don't have any loyalty to them politically or otherwise. So we very much hold ourselves out to be independent and objective. You are going to need to be a subject matter expert in the area of financial accounting. Those types of understandings of how you analyze bank accounts and transactions. We want you to be someone that has self-confidence, that has persistence. As I said, to someone naturally who's curious and has an intuitive perception. Really just someone who has common sense and can solve problems and work within a team. Because often these investigations are handled by multiple investigators working as a team together. And more than anything else, we're looking for people who are committed to honesty and fair play and really achieving the goals of a criminal investigation that exposes the truth.
Are there any resources or training that help in your journey?
Well, obviously, continuing education is important. I mean, once we talk about people who come to us with that accounting background or that CFE background or college degrees, there's always continuing education requirements and things that we encourage our investigators to participate in. The ACFE is certainly a great resource for training, and really are almost all of our investigators participate in that on an annual basis and even more frequently than that. And that they really provide quite a good resource of training in different subject matter areas. And then locally, you know, within state government, many times we partner with other state agencies to share information and do trainings together. We might have the Department of Revenue come over and provide us with a training about some things that they're looking for, how they do their business. The Internal Revenue Service will often come and speak to us and to provide training for our investigators, things like that. And so, you know, we have that external training, then we have internal training as well.
What do you wish you had known when you started? You started your law career and you're a defense attorney and then state prosecutor and federal prosecutor, and now you're working for the comptroller's office. What do you wish you had known?
I think what I wish I would have known when I first started practicing law is that the value of a law degree is not just monetary. The value of a law degree is actually being able to do something noble and righteous. I wish I'd known that earlier in my career. I wish I'd gotten into public service much earlier. The moment that I became an elected prosecutor, the moment I became a public servant, it clicked for me. I knew that that was what felt right to me and where my talent was best used. And so for me, I wish I had ignored all of the trappings and all of the lure of financial success and really focused on professional success that helped make things better in my community and now in my state. And I've spent the last 16, 17 years really trying to lean in towards that public service. I would tell anybody who's getting started in a law degree or in investigations or auditing, if you can serve your local government, your state government, your federal government in a way that gives back to the community, it can be quite rewarding and fulfilling beyond just the paycheck.
In your career, what was the most rewarding or unique case that you had?
I've had so many, Robert. My background as an elected and appointed prosecutor has been much more than just financial fraud cases. Those are quite important.
Yeah, I understand. I completely understand. That's really why I'm leaving it open for anything that's either financial or non-financial.
When I became U.S. attorney in Memphis and in West Tennessee, we had a real, and we still do, we had a real bad violent crime problem. And really a violent crime problem that was associated with the unlawful possession and use of firearms. I'm quite proud of the fact that overall, not with respect to any one particular case, but overall, I was able to implement a real targeted program towards unlawful possession and use of firearms by convicted felons and other people who are engaged in dangerous behavior and really bring them to justice and incapacitate them. And as a result of that, we could really see the impact on the lives of people in West Tennessee. And I served under Attorney General Jeff Sessions and then under Attorney General William Barr. And both of them were really focused on not just what they called output, but outcomes. You know, output is the number of cases that you can indict or the number of investigations you can prosecute or the number of defendants you can put in prison. But outcomes really are, what is the effect on the crime rate? How many less homicides do we have this year as opposed to last year in Memphis as a result of gun crime? And I'm quite proud and was really rewarded by the fact that some of the initiatives that we took on when I was U.S. Attorney in the Department of Justice really made an impact on violent gun crime in Memphis and West Tennessee and drove that violent crime rate down. That is a positive outcome that saved lives, human lives, in West Tennessee. And so I'm quite proud of that.
Well, good. Well, thank you. I will tell you that talking to pretrial services, probation office, yeah, the guns and drugs are like, you know, pretty easy. It's the financial crimes, boy, makes it difficult because it's not, I don't know, it's just a lot of working pieces to it. It's interesting.
You're exactly right, Robert. And if I can follow up on that, that's a really good point. Violent crime and narcotics offenses, they happen in such real time that many times an arrest is made and there has to be an immediate legal response to that, right? There's a custodial arrest. There's a prosecution and that moves forward fairly quickly. And that evidence in that case is gathered and put together fairly quickly.
Yeah. And usually it's a felon. Yep. He had a gun. Yep. There you go.
That's right. You know, when you start talking about complex financial fraud cases or healthcare fraud cases or other types of really complex tax fraud schemes or public corruption matters, those are the types of cases that don't get solved overnight. Those are not the things that move quickly through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And they take months and years to develop, develop confidential informants, to develop, gather evidence, to make sure that you have sufficient evidence to meet the burden of proof. In fact, when I was leaving the Department of Justice last year, I did a series of interviews with local news outlets and other people, and many of them asked me what my biggest regret was, what was the unfinished business of the U.S. Attorney's Office as I was leaving. And I had actually identified public corruption because I said I felt like I didn't have enough time to really develop the cases that need to be developed because it takes so long. And that's really a shame, but it's necessary to get it right. And now I find myself working in the area of public corruption and financial fraud in government agencies every day, and I love it. And so what was perhaps a regret or an unfinished business that I had as a federal prosecutor, I now get to do every day in the comptroller's office. And so I don't want anyone to ever minimize the importance of those cases or exclude those cases just because we're all focused on violent crime or narcotics. I think they're all important. every violation of the law is an affront to our government and an affront to our people and needs to be taken seriously. And so I'm so pleased to be able to work in this area now where really we can make a difference and maybe get speed up the process a little bit in those cases and put some extra priority on those.
You kind of already answered a question I had in my head, but thank you.
Yeah.
Was there any unfinished business or lost opportunity while you're U.S. Attorney's office? And you're like, and I completely understand what you're saying. It takes months and years to do a white collar case. It just does. And it's just the nature of the beast. It just really is. The local thug out there with the gun, yeah, it's important to take him down. Don't get me wrong. But to take down an organization takes just a lot longer. It just does.
If you're going to dig into a wire fraud, a conspiracy,
whether it's violent related, which, you know, and you know as well as I do that most of this violence related is somehow, some way greed motivated. It's not, oh, you happen to be, you know, sleeping with my girlfriend. I hate you. I'll shoot you. You know, that type of thing. It's more of a, you're on my turf and my turf is my power. My turf is where I get my money. You know, that type of thing.
Well, certainly I prosecuted multiple gang organizations and organized crime in Memphis and West Tennessee that would engage in violence for its own sake, but often would also engage in violence for purposes of financial gain.
Obviously. Right, exactly.
Whether it's the drugs trade, stolen firearms, human trafficking, all types of, you know, credit card fraud, identity theft, all types of things that would fund the organization. And so you're exactly right. Building a case of conspiracy or wire fraud or bank fraud or RICO or Vicar against an organization with multiple players, gathering proof of each of their criminal responsibility does take time, and it takes a bit of strategic thinking about it as well. When you talk about a lost opportunity at the U.S. Attorney's Office, I guess I can't go through this interview without at least mentioning the impact of COVID on my last year as U.S. Attorney. In March of 2020, the whole world shut down, and that included the federal courts as well. And so my ability to continue to move forward in federal grand juries, to move forward with federal law enforcement component agencies, and to continue the pace of output and outcome that I talked about earlier was really slowed. And at the same time that we were slowed in our procedural ability just to move cases through the system, of course, I used to say, you know, COVID may have stopped all of us, but it did not stop criminal activity. So at the same time that we were slowing the grand jury process or the court process or jury trials or even bringing people into custody or maybe releasing people from custody, we still had criminal activity that was taking advantage of that and exploiting that gap. And so you want to talk about lost opportunities. Think about all of the cases that are now kind of backed up on state and federal court dockets. They got slowed down by COVID. They got lost by COVID. How many offenders were turned out of local jails or state penitentiaries as a result of some fear of exposure who now are continuing to reoffend or violate their probation? And so there's a real impact to the criminal justice system and lost opportunities for public safety and for accountability just by virtue of the fact that it upended all of our processes and our procedures and our physical ability to get into a courtroom and litigate cases.
I saw so many cases where it was, Your Honor, I can't go to prison even though I'm guilty because there may be COVID there. I might as well go ahead and stay home and have COVID or potentially be exposed to COVID. And sure enough, they didn't spend a day in prison. They went home. You know, and one of those deals. And especially if you were older, like 60s and, you know, 50, oh, I got health problems. It was a really, really taken into consideration by the judges, good or bad. They took into consideration the health and age of individuals who were committing these crimes. They would not put them in prisons. And whether BOP wanted them today or not, I don't know the answer to that. I just know that there's a lot of people that walked away in a sense and went home that 6 months ago would have been prison in a heartbeat.
That obviously strains and compromises the quality of justice and the protection of our citizens in multiple ways. And it's unfortunate, it's unjust, and we need to be acting quickly to remedy that and to get back to business as usual, I would say.
It'd been better to plead guilty during COVID than plead guilty before COVID, or probably now, because I think now you plead guilty or you're probably going to go to prison.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Ready for the final four questions?
I'll give it my best shot, Robert.
All right, final four. You are a former prosecutor, federal, state, and you're at the comptroller's office. What's your biggest motivation now?
I will tell you that my biggest motivation has remained constant throughout my public service career, and it's even to this day. The best way I can describe it to you is by one word, and that's righteous. Pursuing criminal activity, exposing the truth, holding people accountable is noble and righteous. And that motivates me every day. Getting up every day and only being focused on doing the right thing motivates me because I believe that I'm part of something bigger, because I believe that I'm actually making a difference in the lives, not only me and my family, but my fellow citizens from my state and my nation. My biggest motivation has always been leaning forward to expose the truth, hold people accountable, and really achieve justice. You know, a lot of people in this country have a lot of different notions of what justice is or what justice ought to be or what justice looks like. And I have my own notions about it, too. And so every day I get up looking for that righteous, noble notion of justice that does punish the offender. And by the way, it's okay for us to say that the primary goal of the criminal justice system is to, in fact, punish people. That's okay, because that's what it's for. And at the same time, we're punishing people. Many times we incapacitate violent people. We put them in prison because they are a danger to other people. The other value of those cases is to deter future criminal activity. And I used to have a colleague who used to say, we must do right and we must be seen as doing right. And so that there's a deterrent factor for that. And then if we can correct people, rehabilitate people, and we can provide some improvement so they don't return to the system, I think that's important. But you know who gets overlooked most often is the victim of crimes.
Right.
We focus a whole lot on the criminal offender, on the fraudster, on the gangbanger, on the shooter, on the drug dealer. And we don't focus quite enough, in my opinion, on the victim of crime. And whether it's financial crime, violent crime, sex crime, child abuse, whatever it may be, those scars and those devastating effects of criminal activity can last a lifetime. That demands a reckoning. That demands an accountability. And so for me, leaning forward into that righteous mission every day is what motivates me, and it always will.
What book or books have changed your life or thinking?
Well, Robert, I'm a man of Christian faith. So obviously, if you ask me about a book, I'm going to tell you that the Holy Bible is the book that primarily and continues to daily change my life. Along those same lines,
I'm not going to let you get away with that one, Mike. There's 66 of those in there, depending on if you're Catholic or not. All right, which one?
Well, that's right. I have my favorites, but I would say along those same lines, I do study the Christian faith, and I do read a lot about the interpretation of the Bible and what it means for my life and my future. I do enjoy the works of C.S. Lewis. Mere Christianity is fantastic. During a difficult time in my life, I have found comfort in C.S. Lewis's work, A Grief Observed. Mm-hmm. I recommend it to anyone who is grieving a loss of any kind. It really hits home with me. I generally only read nonfiction. I don't read a whole lot of fiction. And when you start talking about books that kind of intrigue me and that I keep going back to over and over again, I'll give you a few others because I thought about this question. Recently, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote a book entitled A Republic, If You Can Keep It. When you talk about constitutional law and considerations of our republic and our democracy and how we came to be a country and how we can continue to maintain that republic, that's a really good book. When I became U.S. attorney in Memphis, I'm from the rural part of the district. And of course, I grew up in and around Memphis. And so I was generally familiar with Memphis. But I was handed a book by a colleague of mine. And the name of the book is called Rowdy Memphis. And I recommend it to anybody if you want to know all about the history, a lot of good tales and stories about Memphis. It's called Rowdy Memphis, written by John Branston. And I highly recommend it. And I dug into that book, and boy, it gave me a rich, colorful, really historic perspective of Memphis and Shelby County there when I was serving. When I was also U.S. attorney, I had a chance to meet Sam Quinones. Sam Quinones, of course, wrote a book called Dreamland, which studied the true tale of Americans' opioid epidemic. And you want to talk about how we developed as a country into this need for opioids and pharmaceutical painkillers and how it really affected the Appalachian region and ultimately the whole country. That's a really good book. Currently, I'm reading a book by David Brooks called The Second Mountain. Second Mountain is really about the quest for a meaningful and moral life. Throw in one just for fun for you, Robert. I'm a Boston Red Sox fan. For anybody who wants to kind of take a different look at baseball, Jerry Remy, R-E-M-Y, Jerry Remy wrote a book some years ago called Watching Baseball. And it's a really great book, just kind of about the nuts and bolts of baseball and considerations about all types of things that pitchers and catchers and batters and coaches consider in the sweet science of baseball. So there you go. How's that for a book review?
That's a lot more than the average answer, but it's all good. Have you seen the C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert? It came out like 4 or 5 months ago.
I have not seen that. I would like to, and based upon your recommendation, I'll seek it out.
It's called The Most Reluctant Convert. Very good, by the way, about C.S. Lewis's journey in his faith, about going from being an atheist to a reluctant believer, and the arguments that he had in his brain, and how he grew up, and his writings and all that stuff. It's really a one man play that was turned into literally a movie picture. That's what it is.
I'm a big C.S. Lewis fan, and so I'll certainly check that out.
It's well worth your time watching. Let me put it that way. It's well worth your time watching. The Most Reluctant Convert. It just came out last year, 2021. Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100, that you enjoyed or made your job easier. If it's good enough for Mike Donovan, it's good enough for the world, what would that be?
This may be the hardest question you ask me. You don't think about things that you purchased that you use or enjoy or that made your life easier. You just kind of do it, right? I really have struggled with this. I don't really know. A couple of practical things, and then I'll give you one thing that's just kind of personal to me. How about that? In my job now and in my previous work, I've had to travel a fair bit. Even during COVID, I was traveling. I wear a suit pretty much every day of my life, and traveling with suits can be difficult. And so I was able to get my hands on a travel bag. Allows you to pack suits in a way that they don't get wrinkled or messed up, but and yet it kind of rolls up into a duffel bag. And so that... Well, I found that to be really handy, and I use it quite a bit. It's a little black duffel bag, and it kind of lays flat, and you put your suits in it, and then it kind of zips up and rolls up almost like a sleeping bag. It's been really handy for me just as a travel item. Us lawyers wearing suits all the time, when you get on a plane, and that thing is easy to carry on and kind of fold up, but it doesn't wrinkle your suits. On the more personal side, I'll tell you, in the last 12 months, the thing that I've purchased that I enjoyed perhaps the most, I got my law degree at Ole Miss, and so I'm a big Ole Miss Rebel fan. And my son is a freshman in college at Ole Miss. Just this past season, of course, our Ole Miss Rebel football team went to the Sugar Bowl. I was able to get a couple of tickets to the Sugar Bowl for me and my son to go down and see the Rebels lose to the Baylor Bears. And despite the loss, it was an enjoyable trip, a really great memory, and I enjoyed myself for that. So that was a pretty good purchase for us. We went down to New Orleans to the Sugar Bowl.
Cool. That's very interesting. If you had to do something else, if you got your walking papers today, Mike, and said you can no longer practice law and you can no longer part of the comptroller group, what would you be doing?
The only skill the good Lord gave me was to do this. And if you took that away from me, I don't know what I would do. Again, all I ever wanted to be was a prosecutor. I had to become a politician to do it, and it's all I've ever known how to do with any proficiency. But if I had to do something else, I'm very interested in matters of faith. I might be pulled and gravitated towards the church, and perhaps engaged in some type of ministry within the church. I don't know whether that'd be teaching or preaching or serving in some other capacity. And I'm a great lover of music as well. And so even though I'm not great on an instrument, I like to sing and I like music. Of course, I work for the comptroller here in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA. And perhaps in addition to the church, I might try to find some avenue into the music industry. I find that intriguing and rewarding.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, for your time on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And thank you so much for your service. I know your heart's in it, whether it's a state prosecutor, federal prosecutor, and now the chief investigative counsel for the comptroller. I appreciate your service, and thank you so much for being on the podcast. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Robert. It's my pleasure.